On behalf of Matt Mayberry, the director of the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum, our entire staff and boards, I would like to thank you, Paula and Tim and Chris, for allowing us to participate in your outstanding work that you do to both preserve our important regional history and to promote it in events just such as this. I'm really pleased to introduce our first speaker today, Dennis Daly, who's been the assistant manager of special collections at the Pikes Peak Library District since 2007. Prior to moving to Colorado Springs, Dennis worked for 10 years in the Special Collections and Archives Department of New Mexico State University Library. He received his MLS from the University of North Texas in 2006 and has presented and published papers widely both on a national and international level on the archives of Mexico in the Southwest, folk religious traditions of Durango, Mexico, and Mexican-American family history research. Today, Dennis will be presenting a paper entitled Enterprise and Innovation in the Pikes Peak Region. Please welcome Dennis Daly.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you, everybody. Good morning and welcome. It's great to see everybody here. Thanks for coming out and spending part of your day with us, and I'm glad to see a lot of familiar faces here today. How many of you have attended one of these regional history symposia in the past? Excellent. That's kind of what I thought, and we're glad you decided to come back. Since these regional history symposia began in 2004, there probably hasn't been a topic as wide open in terms of variety as the topic that we're going to talk about today, enterprise and innovation in the Pikes Peak region. The papers that you're going to hear, I think, will exemplify this wide openness of this topic, both in the subjects that they talk about and also the time periods that they cover. I think we all have an idea of what we mean by the terms enterprise, innovation, and Pikes Peak region. But I want to quickly set the stage for the papers that are going to follow and give some context for you to analyze the papers that are going to come by defining quickly these terms. Enterprise is defined as an undertaking or project, specifically a bold, difficult, dangerous, or important undertaking, a business venture or company. It's also a willingness to undertake new or risky projects. I think the important thing to think about is that enterprise really has to do with things that are new, perhaps things that have never been tried before, that there's some risk involved, and that it really requires some sort of energy or initiative on the part of some individual or group. Innovation is defined as the art or process of introducing new methods, customs, or devices, a change in the way of doing things. And so again, the core meaning is that the process introduces something new. And you can see in the middle of our English word, innovation, the Latin word nova, which means new. Finally, the Pikes Peak region is a term that we use a lot in this area. We use them a lot in our symposia. It was probably the most loosely defined of the three concepts we're talking about today, and that's because it's meant different things at different times and for different people. So for instance, in the early 19th century, it connoted the largely unexplored and vague region of the American West, newly acquired American West, which was explored by Zebulon Pike in 1806 and 1807. Following the gold discovery of gold in this area in 1858, the term was applied generally to the gold mining regions of the Rocky Mountains. Which subsequently became the territory of Colorado and the state of Colorado. Today, I think the trend is to define the term a lot more narrowly in terms of the geographic region around the mountain, Pikes Peak, and it's even used sort of synonymously for the greater Colorado Springs area. And there are plenty of examples of that, the best probably being the Pikes Peak Library District, right? For the purpose of these regional history symposia, We tend to apply the term in its much more broad and general historic and geographic sense. So while all the papers today are going to talk about enterprise and innovation in the post 1859 sort of US-centric perspective, I think it's important to mention that enterprise and innovation in this region didn't begin with the gold rush or the traders and trappers, but has a long history as long as people have been in this region. Enterprise and innovation really are hallmarks of the human species, and I want to offer a couple of quick examples of that. These are Ute Indian snowshoes, and I think they represent a technical innovation that was mothered by necessity, and it demonstrates that innovation often is a response to some need or condition, in this case an environmental condition, which must be mastered in order for us to thrive in the world. This is a map of the great Comanche trading empire from around the turn of the 19th century. During the 18th and early 19th centuries, the Comanche were really the main brokers of a complex and very successful trade network, multinational trade network, that involved not only the surrounding Indian nations, but also some of the European imperial powers like Britain, France over here, and Spain in the south, and of course later the United States and Mexico. The trade network was centered in the Big Timbers region of the Arkansas River, where William and Charles Bent would later build their celebrated trading fort. And there the Comanche were dealing with goods such as livestock and horses from Spanish New Mexico, corn from the New Mexico Pueblos, buffalo hides from the Plains hunters, guns coming in from the British, all manner of food and goods coming from the East, from the United States, and quite a number of human captives. There was a large trade in human captives, which came from all of these cultures. So having said that, and with those definitions behind us, what I want to focus on for the rest of my paper is the idea of looking at innovation and enterprise through El Paso County inventors and their 19th century patents. This is a topic that staff members of the Special Collections Department have been researching for about a year now with the goal of writing biographical sketches of all of these 19th century inventors that lived in El Paso County. So between 1873 and 1899, there were 230 El Paso County patent applications granted by the U.S. Patent Office. And I need to mention at that time El Paso County included parts of what are now Teller County. Importantly, the Cripple Creek gold mining district, as we'll see with some of the patents. There were 196 inventors who filed for patents in El Paso County during this time. And so you can see by the numbers that many of these inventors had multiple patents. Included among these 196, there were three women who got patents: Martha Anderson, who patented a design for a dress glove; Elizabeth Klopp, a tracing wheel; and Amy F. Robinson, who, along with her husband George, who patented a gear design for bicycles. In order to sort of organize this, we created these categories. So these categories were created by us, but we needed some framework to look at them. And I think it is pretty interesting how it exemplifies some of the history of the region. For instance, some of these categories that have multiple patents: farming and ranching, which has been a major industry here since the beginning and continues to be; mining and milling, of course, with the Cripple Creek gold mining district; railroad, this has been a major, this town was really formed because of the railroad. And then these two other categories here, electrical, mechanical, and household are kind of catch-all. So the numbers are high because there's a lot of variety in what's included in those. Some of these others I think are pretty interesting too. Some patents for artificial limbs, funerary, and we're going to look at a couple of those, and toys and games, et cetera. If we look at the number of patents by year during this time period, you might expect this. You see sort of just a general trend as the 20th century approaches for an increase in the number of patents. However, that's not borne out in patents related to farming and ranching, which pretty much remains steady. There's not really a boom period in farming and ranching. However, in mining and milling, there certainly is a boom period. You can see beginning in 1894 with the development of the Cripple Creek Mining District, the number of patents in this category really jumps. If we look by patents, by place of residence of the inventors, the vast majority were in Colorado Springs, 145. Colorado City and Manitou amounted for about 30. And then Cripple Creek and Victor together, close to 30. And then a lot of the other little towns in the region, some of them the mining areas like Altman and Anaconda, and some of them the farming towns like Eastonville. It gives you an indication. This is a map of 19th century El Paso County. And I wanted to look at where some of these different categories of patents were coming from. So farm and ranch, as you might expect, you see the patents a lot in Colorado Springs, and then out here on the Eastern Plains, Cerber, Eastonville, Table Rock, et cetera, and up in Monument. Mining and milling, again, you might expect this, is pretty evenly divided between Colorado Springs area and the Cripple Creek gold mining region, with most of kind of mining patents being up here and the milling patents coming from this area. So I'm going to just quickly go through and show you some examples of some of these patents. And again, there are 230. We're just going to look at a few here, but it'll give you sort of an indication of what these patents were. So, and again, these are all from El Paso County. Apparel, here's a shirt collar and tie holder, patented in 1891. I'm actually wearing one of these today. I don't know if you can see it. A trousers guard from 1899. At this time period, bicycles were one of the main modes of local transportation, and this was to keep your pant leg from getting caught in the bicycle chain. I guess they didn't have duct tape back then. Incredibly interesting artificial limb, patented in 1897, and very, very sophisticated. The steam pile driver, patented by Thomas Skinner. This was a very influential design in steam pile drivers and was used all over the country. Patented here in 1881. Electrical hose signaling apparatus. This was for firefighting hoses. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this patent and William Fowler in a few minutes. An apparatus for raising sunken vessels. Who would have thought, you know, in Colorado Springs? It's interesting because this guy, Joseph Grant, he doesn't show up in city directories or in the U.S. Census as ever living here. So I think he was just passing through. He may have been involved in mining activities in some regard. He and his brothers operated businesses both on the East Coast and the West Coast, where they were constructing things like this to raise sunken ships and other devices related to the shipping industry. In the farm and ranch category, a screen for protecting the eyes of horses from 1883, mostly from flies and other insects. A stirrup, and now the stirrup was not invented here. In fact, the stirrup is considered one of the most important inventions in the history of mankind because it allowed man to harness this incredible power of the horse and had enormous consequences, mostly in warfare and political control. But this design for a stirrup was patented here. And Mr. Laughlin said because of the broken terrain around here, it was very common for horses to fall, and the rider needed a way to get his boot out of the stirrup easily so he wouldn't be crushed by the horse. This is a vegetable separator. The vegetable would go up here in this area, and the machine would shake, and would shake all the dirt and debris off of it, and then it would fall down into this receptacle down here. Funerary devices, I mentioned. This is a wonderful one. Ashby McCreary, and I'm going to talk a little bit more in detail about this one in a few minutes, from 1894. Pretty simple device. This one, a coffin platform from 1886, much more ornamental and probably intended for a different strata of the economic strata than Ashby's invention. And household devices, inventions related to window screens and household ventilation were some of the most common household inventions at the time. Here's a cork puller. It's a great invention, and again, we're going to use this later on today. Have our reception. Washing machine. An electric hairbrush. I included this because I know Cal was fascinated by things like this, and he actually pointed out to us these are not actually electric hairbrushes as we might think. It just has some batteries in it that is supposed to have some sort of properties, but doesn't really do anything. In mining and milling, of course, there are some fantastic inventions. This is a miner's candlestick. This one invented in 1895. The miner's candlestick was also called a sticker or a sticking Tommy because they would stick it into the wall, the mine shaft, with this thing here. And it's incredible. Can you imagine that during the late 19th century, candles were the way mines were lit until the invention of the carbide lamp. And so there are over 80 designs for miners' candlesticks in the late 19th century, not all coming from here, but there were several from this area. There's a lot of inventions related to extracting the precious metals from the ores, like this ore washer and concentrator. Here's a rock drill from 1897. In terms of railroad, there's a lot of safety kind of devices like this locking rail joint from 1888. This is a great railroad attachment for a safety bicycle. They would use this to go inspect the tracks or to get workmen out to repair the tracks. And interestingly, these are actually making a comeback, if you can believe it, as a leisure activity. There's so many abandoned rail lines out there that are just beautiful and scenic that people are using these to, in sort of a tourist kind of way, to go travel these old rail lines. The seal lock, well, this seems pretty innocuous. There were more patents in El Paso County for seal locks and seal bolts than any other patents applied for, and these are locks that locked railroad cars. So it was very important for the security of the contents of railroad cars. I guess that's why we see so many. Toys, here's a bucking horse from the Kellum brothers who lived up in the Cripple Creek Mining District. And this is Amy Robinson's and her husband George's design for variable driving gear for a bicycle, 1894. You can see it does not have a chain. This is actually a drive shaft. So you wouldn't need the trouser guard if you rode this bicycle. Okay, so now I want to present some brief biographical sketches of a few of these 19th century El Paso County inventors, people whose names largely are unknown to us today. Some of them were long-term residents of this area, and some of them, like Mr. Grant, were just passing through. Still, they all made their own unique contributions to the development of the Pikes Peak region. So again, the research and writing for these biographies is a project being carried out by several members of the Special Collections staff, Amy Anderson, Sandy Fletterjohn, Susie Stepanek, Chris Nickel, Bill Thomas, Tim Blevins, myself, Sharon Conan, and Marta Norton. So what I'm going to present today is just a couple of these, and it's a mix of my own work along with the work of these other people. Joshua Ambrose was born July 5, 1810 in North Sutton, New Hampshire. He attended Madison University, which is now Colgate University, a Baptist seminary in Madison County, New York in 1831. He became a missionary in the American Baptist Home Mission Society and was ordained in 1834. He had a long and fruitful career in the ministry. Ambrose was a circuit rider. He's considered one of the last great circuit riders. And he established between 35 and 40 churches in northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin during his lifetime. In 1860, while he was residing in Kane County, Illinois, Ambrose patented an improved design for an oil lamp. In the patent application, Ambrose claimed that the unchecked escape of combustible vapors from conventional oil lamps could be uncomfortable and hazardous to people in enclosed rooms. And he said, quote, that frequently they ignite from the flame of the lamp and often cause explosion. So if you can imagine living in a time when your lighting source might explode in front of you. The principal improvement of his design for oil burning lamps lay in the creation of a tube that would allow the vapors to come from the lamp and come up to the flame where they would be burned, and eliminating the noxious fumes and the risk of explosion. Ambrose later patented other oil and gas lamps and stoves. But Ambrose became associated with the Colorado Springs Company around 1872, and he served in Chicago as a promoter of migration to the Fountain Colony. He owned a building that was located on the corner of Pikes Peak Avenue and Cascade Avenue, which housed the Delmonico restaurant. It's right across from the Colorado Springs Hotel. By August 1873, Ambrose was actually living and preaching in Colorado Springs, and he became a very vocal proponent of the temperance regulations of the Fountain Colony, and he wrote a long column in the Colorado Springs Gazette where he was incensed that intoxicating drinks were being served in the town. So in 1873 in Colorado Springs, he filed to have his 1860 patent reissued, this patent, as its original 14-year term was expiring. And this was the first patent application in El Paso County. By 1876, Ambrose had left Colorado Springs, and he filed for another reissue of the patent from Plattsville, Colorado. And by 1880, he was back in the area of his old ministry in the rural areas of northwest Chicago and apparently never came back to Colorado Springs. He died in LaGrange, Cook County, Illinois, February 10, 1895. These reissued patents, he assigned the patents to the Edward Miller Company, which was a lamp-making company in Connecticut. And they became the center of a lawsuit where Edward Miller sued the Bridgeport Brass Company in 1877, claiming patent infringement. The case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the Bridgeport Brass Company, and it set precedent in U.S. law regarding patent reissues. Have any of you heard of Moses Baldwin before? I'm curious, because this is probably one of the most prominent people whose biographies we're working on. Moses Baldwin's potato digger was a hand-guided plow that excavated potatoes and other subsoil growing edible plants from the ground. A series of revolving screens separated the potatoes from any adhering soil and deposited them in a row or in a receptacle. Moses Marcellus Baldwin was born in Knox County, Tennessee in 1844. During the Civil War, he served 3 years in the 3rd Tennessee Cavalry and spent 7 months as a prisoner of war in the Confederate prison camp at Andersonville. Baldwin came to Alma, Colorado in 1877. He dabbled in mining at Leadville and had a mercantile store and also was farming in El Paso County in 1882. The Colorado State Census in 1885 shows Baldwin and his wife Sarah and their 4 children living in the Manitou area, which was probably Manitou Park, not Manitou Springs. Manitou Park eventually became Woodland Park. In 1890, Baldwin was appointed postmaster at Woodland Park, and the town of Woodland Park was actually incorporated in his store in 1890. In 1891, he was one of 3 men presenting a proposal to the Colorado legislature to organize and establish the County of Crystal. Crystal County was to be carved out of El Paso, Park, Douglas, and Jefferson counties, creating a new county in the geographic center of the state. Between 1891 and 1899, during 8 years of discussion, the new county was alternately known as Crystal County, Sylvanite County, Cripple Creek County, Rhyolite County, and then in March 1899, the county was actually created and named Teller County, right? In 1892, Baldwin and his brother James became directors of the Free Coinage Gold Mining Company. So this is really early in the Cripple Creek Mining District. They located their offices in Colorado Springs. Colorado newspapers reported that Moses Baldwin had large mining interests in the Cripple Creek gold fields. In 1892, he was elected as representative from El Paso County to the state legislature 9th General Assembly. On October 6, 1893, Baldwin was an invited speaker at an event called the Great Potato Bake, where farmers at the Divide at Monument fed about 2,000 people. 130 varieties of Colorado-grown potatoes were exhibited. In 1896, the Republican Party elected Baldwin a delegate to both their state and congressional conventions. On March 14, 1896, a supplement to the Colorado City Iris featured an article on the developing Woodland Park, and the author said, "The Honorable M.M. Baldwin may very properly be called the father of Woodland Park. 18 years ago, he and his brother James, now postmaster at that place, located homesteads and have resided there ever since. A portion of their ranch is located in the town site, and they own several hundred acres adjoining the same. Mr. Baldwin is one of the best-known men in El Paso County. He is a typical Western man and never fails to stand up for Colorado. He's always had faith in the future of the region in which he has so long resided and has labored and spent hundreds of dollars in prospecting for gold in the hills around the towns." Baldwin died in Woodland Park July 28, 1912, and was buried in the town that he helped found. William Fowler, I mentioned this invention a little bit earlier. William Fowler was born in London, England in 1855. He came to the United States when he was 16 and first lived in Boston, where he studied dentistry. In 1883, Dr. Fowler came to Colorado Springs and formed a professional relationship with Dr. Charles E. Edwards, another pioneer dentist in Colorado Springs. Dr. Fowler appears in the Colorado Springs City Directory in 1886, where he's listed as a dentist with a practice at 18 1/2 Tejon Street. Dr. Fowler became one of the most well-known dentists in Colorado Springs. Has anyone heard of Dr. William Fowler? Interesting. In 1899, Colorado Governor Job Cooper appointed him to the first state board of dental examiners. Dr. Fowler was also a charter member of the El Paso County Odontological Society, created at a meeting of ethical dentists held on May 15, 1902. Dentistry was quite a bit different than our conception of it now. The society eventually would become the Colorado Springs Dental Society. Dr. Fowler also was well known outside of his professional circle and led a very active social life. He held important positions in the International Order of Odd Fellows. He was a charter member of the Elks Club, and probably most importantly in relation to his patents, he was a member of the Jackson Hose Company No. 2, which was a volunteer firefighting company in Colorado Springs. In the decades immediately after the founding of the town, the volunteer fire companies were at the center of the city's social life. Many of the firefighters and their families were listed among Colorado Springs' most prominent residents. So combining his passion for public service as a firefighter and his interest in electricity, in the early 1890s, Dr. Fowler invented several devices that enhanced the efficiency of firefighting services of his day. Three of his patents, which two electrical hose signaling devices and an electrical arranged hose coupling, provided much improved means of communication between firefighters at the end of the hose and the person operating the pump or the engine at the other end of the hose. So using a simple bell ringing signal protocol made possible by Dr. Fowler's inventions, firefighters were able to communicate more effectively in the loud, often smoke-filled environments that were typical of large fires. Being able to command the presence or absence of water greatly improved the effectiveness of the firefighting effort. Also, these devices made it possible to warn others of some impending danger. According to the Colorado Springs Gazette, Dr. Fowler's invention attracted a good deal of attention among firefighters who pronounced it an excellent thing. Dr. Fowler remained in Colorado Springs throughout his life, practicing dentistry for nearly 30 years. Tragically, on April 12, 1912, he was adjudged insane by the El Paso County Court, and on that same day he was taken to a hospital in Pueblo for treatment, and he died there about a year later. This device is just fascinating to me. Ashby McCreary was born April 3rd, 1824 in Franklin County, Illinois, and he worked with us on his family's farm as a young man. He married Sarah Mitchell in 1844, and the couple raised four children while working several hundred acres in Franklin County. The McCrearys moved to Colorado Springs in 1883 when Ashby was nearly 60 years old. In 1888, Ashby purchased a home at 410 South Weber Street, and he lived there until his death. Has anyone heard of Ashby McCreary? In 1884, at the age of 60, McCreary filed and received a patent for a device to lower coffins into graves. The invention was a simple A-frame structure made of wood with pulleys and ropes and a winding crank, which would make it easier to place caskets in the ground, he said. In operation, the frame would be rolled over to the gravesite and then spread open above the hole. And according to the patent application, McCreary said, the operator then, after buckling the straps around the coffin, can, by grasping the crank of the windlass or drum, carefully and steadily allow the coffin to descend into the grave. The patent application doesn't state his interest or inspiration in creating this device. Between about 1894 and 1896, McCreary became involved in gold mining in the Cripple Creek district, eventually making some profit. When he and his wife celebrated their golden wedding anniversary in 1894, the newspaper reported, "Perhaps no couple ever before celebrated their golden wedding by getting a good interest in a gold mine, as have the McCrearys." On September 22, 1895, McCreary's wife, Sarah, died, and she was buried in Evergreen Cemetery. And about 18 months later, McCreary, who was then about 73 years old, married Anna Bullock in Colorado Springs, and he continued working well into his 70s. The last job he had was as a clerk and coal salesman for the Union Ice and Coal Company. In 1901, he submitted a letter detailing the McCreary family history to the Colorado Springs Century Chest. This was a time capsule addressed to the citizens of Colorado Springs of the 21st century. And a lot of you probably know the Century Chest was opened on January 1st, 2001, and its contents brought back to life, including letters and photographs and memorabilia. And one of our presenters today, Judy Finley, has edited and published a volume of the Century Chest letters. On the 4th of July, 1914, while outside his Weber Street home feeding his chickens, McCreary, now 90 years old, was struck in the arm by a stray .32 caliber bullet fired from a celebrant's revolver. The newspaper reported that he had not heard the shot because of the noise made by exploding firecrackers. He felt a stinging sensation in his arm and looked down and noticed he had a hole in his coat sleeve. Fortunately, he wasn't seriously hurt. McCreary died soon after turning 94 on April 12, 1918, and he was also buried in Evergreen Cemetery. He was one of the oldest residents of Colorado Springs at the time of his death. So these are just a few of the 196 untold stories of 19th century El Paso County inventors, men and women whose initiative and innovative ideas were recognized by United States patents. They were also among the countless everyday folk, largely forgotten to history, who nevertheless played their roles in the civic, business, and cultural development of the Pikes Peak region. And I think these are people whose stories deserve to be told. And that's why we're here today. And I think you're going to hear some wonderful stories today. And I thank you very much for your time.
you, Dennis. As most of you in the audience know, Pikes Peak Library District has a literal embarrassment of riches in terms of the tremendously talented staff that's dedicated to really innovative historical research. And our next presenter, Katie Rudolph, is representative of that. Katie is the Special Collections Photo Archivist for PPLD. She holds a Master's of Library and Information Science from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Her undergraduate work is in journalism. Prior to moving to Colorado Springs, Katie held positions at the Wisconsin Historical Society, Wisconsin Public Television, and the University of Wisconsin's Helen Louise Allen Textile Collection. Today, we're pleased to announce that Katie will be presenting a program entitled Bumps in the Road, The Spirit of Enterprise and the Sociability Tour of 1914. Please help me welcome Katie.
Wholly unclassable, almost impassable, scarcely jackassable. This was a slogan that was used to describe roads in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. At that time, roads were not paved. When it rained, roads turned to mud, as you can see. And when it was dry, they turned to dust. A cry for improved road conditions came about in the 1880s with bicyclists, and then continued into the early 20th century with automobilists. In 1913, the Colorado to the Gulf Highway Association was formed. They had the intent of creating a highway that would go from Denver down to Galveston. The highway was built by convicts. The cost of the highway was on the counties, and they were accountable for creating this road. In January of 1914, the highway was almost completed, and the Chamber of Commerce in Colorado Springs announced that it would be giving a sociability tour. At that time, sociability tours were either leisurely trips to nearby towns, a day long, maybe a weekend long. Sometimes they were races. But this sociability tour was completely different. It was in the spirit of enterprise. The intent was to promote the Pikes Peak region as a tourist destination. And secondly, it was to promote auto travel on this newly completed highway. In 1913, there were about a little over a million automobiles operating in the United States. So this tour was really capitalizing on that excitement of the automobile. And it was also going to demonstrate the ease of travel on the new highway. This tour, the sociability tour, was 2,500 miles long round trip. It was hailed as the longest sociability tour of the time. At that time, you know, the road conditions were poor. They were unpaved, like I said. Highway services were scant, and the reliability of automobiles was you know, terrible. So needless to say, there were some bumps in the road for the sociability tour of 1914. By March of 1914, letters were arriving daily at the Colorado Springs Chamber of Commerce from towns along the proposed route. Everyone wanted to be part of the itinerary. Of course, not every town could be visited by the sociability tour. But by April, the official itinerary was announced. It would go from Colorado Springs down to Pueblo, crossing New Mexico, and heading southeast to Amarillo. From Dallas, it would go down to Austin and San Antonio, and then curve to Galveston. And the return trip would be through Oklahoma and Kansas. Who were the participants of the sociability tour? It was all men, prominent businessmen and professionals from this area. I'm not going to list all of them, but there were attorneys, bankers, physicians, representatives from all the area hotels, the Incline Railway, Senator A.T. Stewart. And I'm just going to list some of the names that kind of come up in this discussion. J.H. Jenkins was from Pueblo. He was the captain of the tour and the general secretary of the Pueblo Commerce Club. G.B. Merrick was the official photographer, and you'll be seeing a lot of his photographs in this presentation. These are available at Special Collections and also the Pioneers Museum. L. Mark Shuffle was the marshal of the tour. He owned Mark Shuffle Motor Company. A.W. Henderson was the publicity officer. He was also the secretary of the Chamber of Commerce in Colorado Springs and the Mountain Division of the Colorado to the Gulf Highway Association. And finally, T.C. Kirkwood was the director of the Chamber of Commerce. The tour was supposed to start on May 4th, 1914. There were some delays. The first one was the Ludlow Massacre that had occurred on April 20th. The tour would be going through that area. It was a little bit dangerous at the time. Secondly, poor weather and road conditions had been reported. In April, precipitation, as you can see on this map, was very heavy in Texas. In some areas, 6 to 8 inches of rain fell. There was also torrential flooding in New Mexico at that time. In 3 days, 9.5 inches of rain had fallen. So the Canadian River was flooded in New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. The following day, May 5th, they still hadn't left, but they did make some films at the Garden of the Gods. They filmed 6 automobiles. There was still some debate if they should wait another week, but there was a feeling that traveling through these poor road conditions would add even more publicity to the event, so they went for it. And on May 6th, from the Burns Theater at 7 o'clock in the morning, the party left. There were 6 automobiles. They've been identified mostly as Cadillac Roadsters and touring cars. They were decorated with pennants and American flags, and they had paint on the hoods. So they plan to reach Walsenburg by noon and Trinidad by the evening. This is taken in Trinidad. They're fording the creek. And this is in the strike zone. The caption of this photograph is U.S. regulars in the strike zone helping one of the autos out of the ditch. They did hit some trouble on the Raton Pass. There were heavy rains the week prior. There had been a mudslide the day before. And so it took them 14 hours to reach Raton from Pueblo. There were plans for Governor Ammons of Colorado to shake hands with Governor McDonald of New Mexico at the top of the pass, and those plans were scrapped, of course. Day 2, after a night's rest, they left Raton and had lunch on the prairie. But they hit some trouble again. They had to build 2 makeshift bridges that day and pull cars out of lots of mud. The first accident of the trip happened in New Mexico. The steering column on one of the cars of H.H. Stevens failed, and J.J. Pierce, manager of the Alamo Hotel, was thrown 10 feet, falling on his back, but he was not seriously injured. They crossed into Texas at Texline and, quote, at once tasted that much desired and always manifested Southern hospitality. In general, the tourists were greeted like rock stars wherever they went in Texas. when they came into town, they were greeted by fleets of automobiles, brass bands, parades, large crowds. They were given banquets, luncheons, barbecues, a demonstration on bull riding. And they were shown, you know, the highlights of the towns they visited, and were often given commemorative pennants to place on their cars. In the return, the sociability tourists handed out literature. They showed films of this region. They made publicity deals with local newspapermen and gave numerous speeches. Probably the best example of Southern hospitality occurred in Amarillo. The Canadian River had washed the bridge out into Amarillo. So the Chamber of Commerce in Amarillo offered to send the cars by rail from Dalhart to Amarillo. In Clarendon, a grapevine arbor was erected in the middle of the street and deliciously cool grape juice served by the young ladies. In Memphis, Texas, a chuck wagon feed was held with a bull riding demonstration. And you can see there was a band here. They visited the oil wells in Electric, Texas. Took many photographs there. Here they are at Lake Wichita in Wichita Falls, Texas. Here's an example of the crowds that would come to meet them. This was in Decatur, Texas. Governor Colquitt of Texas had intended to meet the party here, but he had to send his regrets at the last moment. In Marlin, Texas, they were treated to an afternoon at the Hot Springs. This is the Hot Springs Pavilion in Marlin. Once they reached Dallas, they had heard road conditions to Austin and San Antonio were very poor, and so they decided to reverse their route. So they were going to go straight down to Galveston and loop to San Antonio and Austin later. On May 15th, they left Bryan, Texas, and they experienced some difficulty crossing the Navasota River. The Houston and Texas Central Railroad Company actually offered use of their tracks for the group to cross the river, but actually another route was found, so they didn't have to do that. But said one member of the party, "It showed that the people of Texas will go the limit for a stranger." So on May 16th, the party left Houston, and they came upon 35 miles of these shell roads, these white shell roads that were very, very smooth. They were so smooth that the party was pulled over by a police officer on a motorcycle. They were going 67 miles per hour. The state law of Texas at the time ordered that no motorist should exceed 18 miles per hour at any time or place. They assured they would be on their best behavior from that point on. They reached the city limits of Galveston, and there was a welcome banner. Films were made, and Mayor Fisher presented them with a key to the city of Galveston, inscribed with, "Galveston, no speed limit here." T.C. Kirkwood presented the mayor with a banner reading "Colorado to the Gulf." They continued to the Gulf of Mexico, where they, quote, baptized their cars in the Gulf of Mexico. And then members of the party donned bathing suits, and with a dash that might have reminded some of the old swimming hole, plunged into the surf. They were given a crab supper later that night. It was some of the tour members, it was their first crab supper, so the mayor had to demonstrate how to crack crabs. A.W. Henderson spoke at the dinner saying, "We made the trip after hundreds had advised against making the attempt. We are here to cooperate in the building of a road, and in blazing the way, we feel we have accomplished something worthwhile." The following day, the tour left Galveston and headed to Texas City, to the Army camp there. This Army camp, I should mention, was completely wiped out in the hurricane of 1915 and never rebuilt. They ran into some more trouble the following day. They left in the early morning and drove 60 miles until midnight. The rain, mud, and floods were so bad that they were stalled in the high water outside of El Campo all night. They spent another day in El Campo because, as you can see, the water was just way too high. The Navidad River had high water, and many bridges were washed out the following day, and the party made 10 miles in 3 hours. Said A.W. Henderson, "Our cars did not have boat attachments, and we had to abandon them at Louise, some 160 miles from here in San Antonio. The mud didn't bother us except to check the speed slightly, but when it comes to 40-mile-wide creeks, well, automobiles were not built for that kind of work, at least not the 1914 models." So the month of May in Texas, it was the second wettest month on record, and basically every river had been flooded. So here they are at Louise, Texas, on their way to San Antonio. And here they are in San Antonio. They stayed overnight, saw the Alamo, the Army Post, and some of the residential neighborhoods. But then they had to continue by rail the rest of the way. So they made their way through Texas, up through Oklahoma and Kansas. Parties would stop at the depots and greet them, and they, you know, would make a brief visit. So back in Colorado, a homecoming celebration was being planned for the party. Mayor McKesson issued a formal request that all citizens of Colorado Springs attend the greeting at the depot. They expected a crowd of 5,000. The party arrived on Wednesday, May 27th at 11:25 on the number 7 Santa Fe. One of the Crystal Park Auto Company's big touring cars was rented, but it was not driven, it was pulled by hundreds of men, just to show their thanks. Romaine Fielding promised to have his motion picture cameras rolling. Mayor McKesson hailed the tourists as both benefactors and heroes for their public relations work in New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas, and commended their bravery in passing through all these floods and storms. He likened the party's journey to Roosevelt's discovery of a river in Brazil in 1913. He said, "You in a few short weeks discovered a multitude of streams that never existed prior to your advent into Texas." He also mentioned that while Roosevelt lost 50 pounds on his expedition, the sociability tour members returned fat, bronzed, and handsome. A.W. Henderson also spoke declaring the sociability tour a success. He also remarked on the world of publicity that had been secured. Practically every newspaper in Texas ran a cut of the map of the Colorado to the Gulf Highway, and the Associated Press and the United Press also ran columns. And I'll just give you a couple quotes from other tour members. L.A. Puffer said, "Never had such a time in my life. We met with the most cordial receptions at every point." Here is the, I guess it's a little hard to see, but the car being pulled by men. So while the sociability tour accomplished its goals of promoting the Pikes Peak region and auto tourism, it also produced some other effects. There was more press coverage, not only on the tour, but of the region. Features were made in the Christian Science Monitor and Automobile Journal. It also added to the establishment of the American Association of State Highway Officials in 1914. And this group really gave states a voice in advocating for national road improvement. And it also created this legacy of promotion. The sociability tours continued well into the 1930s. In fact, by July of 1914, there were plans in place for a 1,600-mile combination sociability tour and endurance run, covering the newly opened Colorado and Utah section of the Pikes Peak ocean-to-ocean highway. So despite the bumps in the road, the sociability tour and the spirit of enterprise lived on.
Thank you.